Welcome to Art. With.
Fiona Verity.
Say it again.
Fiona?
No.
Fiona Verity.
And Julie Nicholson.
Oh, recording in progress.
Yes. Recording in progress.
This is Fiona. I'm Julie.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Nice to meet you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. All good.
Does it sound good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you've got a lovely studio, Headley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look at that. It's massive.
It's massive.
Oh, you got your heater on as well. Blush.
Ooh.
Stop it.
That is a great studio.
Yeah, I used to have a really bigger studio next door, actually, but now there's like six people in it.
Oh, really?
Wow.
So yeah, you're in Margate, right?
Do you want to see? This is where it's
at. Yeah.
Come on, take us for a walk, Headley.
Yeah. So, this is... I've got two motorbikes in my studio at the moment.
Health and safety, Headley.
I know. They're only in there from last night. I'm rearranging some stuff.
Oh, and the skeleton. I like him. What's his name?
Artie, of course. So this is... I used to be in this studio. This is...
Wow.
So is it like a big shared studio space?
Well, that's it. It's like an old warehouse. And then I moved here about 6 years ago. We set up the first studio here, and it's an old furniture warehouse, with lots of different units in it, and we set it up, and then I moved to this smaller studio earlier this year, and some new young artists from Open School East, or graduates from Open School East, which is a kind of art school in Margate. Took on that studio as well. So, but yeah, it's kind of growing, you know, here. It's like studios from the 80s, you know. It's kind of big, warehousey, kind of, it's absolutely freezing in the winter. I have a really, like my heater.
Oh, I
remember
having a heater like that when I was little.
Yeah. Like, it's so hot today.
Yeah,
here.
Look at me, look, I've got all my layers on. I've got a hat on, everything. You have to wear a quilted boiler suit and, you know, heat yourself because and my ceiling goes all the way up. Look.
It's
triple high, no insulation, nothing. So
yeah,
if it's 2 degrees outside, it's 2 degrees in here.
Yeah.
I went to uni in Swansea and we used to have baths with bobble hats on. I mean, it was.
Yeah.
But now I honestly can't imagine it, because you get...
I don't know, because we're used to it. Honestly, we've gone soft. If it's 18 here, we're like, oh, it's a bit chilly.
Yeah.
I know, but everybody's turning the heating down here because it's just got so expensive. So
I know.
Everybody you see is wearing a bubble hat. Everybody's wearing a bubble jacket everywhere.
But that's what it was like.
Everywhere.
My dad would always say, just put another jumper on.
Yeah, that's what it's like, yeah.
You do get to the point.
Mind you, Headley, in Australia, you'd be surprised, I've never been as cold in a house anywhere but Sydney because they don't have insulation, no one's heard of a curtain, and no one has central heating.
Right.
And it's freezing. It's really weird. Like, it's.
But it's so short. The season's so short. We have winters like 3 or 4 months, so you just get on with it.
Well, you do, don't you?
It's gone forever here. I didn't really know that I had a big coat in London, and I didn't really. But it wasn't until I came to live in Margate, which is it's in the south, but it faces the North Sea.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know that how cold it could get in the winter, you know, with the wind until I was here. You think, oh, it'll be fine, you know, but the wind just makes it really cold.
I think a bitter wind.
Oh my god,
my nan would say,
it's bitter out, love. Get you,
But do you think, like, we'd love to talk to you a little bit about Margate, because you know, what we hear, it's like really becoming quite an amazing hub, maybe because it's so cold, everyone's inside painting. But A, do you know Tracy Emin? And B, what's it like living in Margate?
And C, can you get us an interview with Tracy Emin?
No, I don't know Tracy Emin that now. But I'll come back to that. There is a there's a quite a big scene happening here. So I moved here about 6 years ago, and people said, "Well, why are you moving there?" And I said, "Because it's happening. Things are happening." Okay. And it was really cheap. Studio was really cheap, and housing was really cheap. You know, so it's like perfect. And then Open School East. Well, there were a few studios, and people had moved a bit earlier, and they'd set up some studios. And there was Limbo and Crate, and kind of little studios that had set up. And then Open School East opened here, which is a used to be in East London, a kind of free courses for applicants, for kind of avant-garde kind of art course. It was really interesting. And then also there's another school called Margate School of Art open. So and obviously Turner and Turner is really active. The Turner, which is a gallery, is really active.
Yeah.
You know, so it just sort of blew up really, really fast. So when we came, we didn't think that it was going to be quite so quick that it happened. But the next thing you knew is in all the Sunday supplements and everything. And over the period, it just went crazy. So when we first came, you couldn't get a cup of coffee. And now, you know, every other place is a coffee bar and, you know, a project.
Now you can't get a park.
And yeah. So really crazy.
But what
yeah. So it's really, I mean, it's fantastic.
That's great. But what do you think started the impetus down there? Like, do you think people, it was too expensive in London and so it just... Yes. So, but why did it happen in Margate than somewhere else?
Well, there's two places. There are two choices. There was Margate and Hastings. So there are two main places. And what happened really was the Olympics and really changed what happened in East London. So everybody had studios in East London, and then that completely changed everything. So there was a kind of everywhere closed, turned into, you know, housing chain. Everything changed then, and very quickly after that, everybody was starting to look for a new space. Yeah. Rents absolutely shot up, and so everybody was in kind of my age bracket, just right, okay, we're getting out. And then also a load of people went, okay, why do I live in a one bedroom house? You know, when I could buy a family home. And so 30 somethings were kind of moved to 30 something designers. And stuff, and entrepreneurs moved here to have babies and, you know, live a nicer life. So Hastings was the other place. I think both places have got a kind of gallery, you know, as a centre. You know, Hastings, you know, it's got its contemporary, and Margate's also got one. You know, so I think that really helped. It kind of provided a little bit of focus. And so back places, and it was for everybody. It was really a kind of choice. You know, which one do you go to? At the time, I was working at. I was head of art and design at the University of East London. Mm-hmm. And from here, that's quite a good journey. It's about an hour. And I'd share the drive with somebody else and take passengers and stuff to London. So that worked out really well for quite a long time. And so, yeah, I could be here and commute up to London and back. Whereas with Hastings, it's a little harder. It's a little bit further. So, I mean, it was literally a kind of practical choice. For me to come here.
Yeah, it's really interesting how things happen like that. I find, you know, like this sort of logistics and the how places become known for something is really fascinating. Yeah. Like just lots of people like-minded at the same time.
Yeah.
Sort of.
But you just need that sort of epicenter and then the infrastructure. Like you say, like if you can get up to town in an hour, then it's doable.
Yeah, exactly. And then you need to kind of follow up from that. And then Carl Freeman came and, but Margate was already happening. I mean, it's been happening for quite a long time, but it's been quite quiet, quite a kind of secret, if you like. You know, there's a kind of festival every weekend. There was quite a really big kind of queer scene, LGBT, that's been here. And then was the sort of a new crowd that was in that was quite exciting. You know, when we first came, it was really mixed, and you know, everybody be at the pub, and then they'd be at the club, and then they'd be, you know, you go.
Yeah, cool.
Everybody mixed up together. Now it's a bit different. You know, there are definitely different communities emerged. You know, which is interesting too.
Yeah. It sounds like a really exciting time to be somewhere. Yeah.
I can remember.
I mean, it's a bit mad now. You can't get a flat. You know.
I bet all you. I bet all the original people are like, right, that's it, we're moving on. We're going to start somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they do say that it's for a lot of people, it's been the first place that they wanted to live after living in London, and they survived living outside of London. And then people have gone off to France or Spain or Portugal or whatever. You know, they've kind of made the next step from that, you know, and I think that that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
That, you know, you can survive without London. And then once you realise you can do that, and of course, pandemic made everybody change their minds, you know, about their relationships.
That's right.
Totally. Anyway, yeah.
Well, and also it's quite interesting because obviously being an artist is very dependent on financial situation as well. And like same in Sydney, we're seeing a big exodus to the country towns and stuff that I think will similarly produce like these great little art spots all over Australia, because it has tended to be, not always, but you know, obviously in the cities, but it's so expensive for art space and you know, with the internet and the pandemic, you can show your work, you know, anywhere really. So
we're
really excited to speak to you, Hedley. You're a very interesting man by all accounts. Well, just on a side note, where's your name from, Hedley?
I come from Cornwall. And so all of my family's from Cornwall, and my name is my grandfather's name, and you know, and so it's in my family. And you can trace it around the world, you know, people that left Cornwall, and you know, my name sort of travelled around the world, you know.
It's a cool name. I've never heard it before.
Yeah, and I've not heard it as a name. I used to live in a village near Hedley in Surrey.
Yeah, that's right. It's a place name.
Yeah.
Normally it's a surname. So I think somewhere along the line it was probably a surname that then became a
Christian name.
Yeah, a Christian name. So
you got an artist name before you were an artist.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, my grandfather was a horseman, you know, he's kind of, you know, I come from people that do, you know, horses and farmers and stuff, you know, so.
Like pole dart.
I was going to say, like Peaky Blinders.
I grew up with Shire horses and stuff, you know, so in the country.
That's cool. Yeah.
Cornwall's beautiful.
Yeah, Cornwall is so beautiful.
And busy, I'd imagine. I was looking at your website, Hedley, and
you're shouting.
Am I shouting?
You're shouting.
Oh,
yeah.
So sorry. He's in England.
I know.
We've got the tinternet.
He can
hear
us.
This is what I do to my mum on FaceTime. Right. So on your website it says Hedley Roberts makes non-portraits of lovers, friends, family, acquaintances, and strangers. Now, I really like the idea of non-portraits. Like, what do you mean by that?
That's the kind of main body of work that I've done for quite a long time. It's so making paintings of people that are irrecognizable as those people. They become irrecognizable through the process of making them. And that's really about not being able to know another person. Or, you know, the way that they present their exterior perhaps enables them to be themselves, but you don't know what their inner life is, or you can never really experience somebody else's experience. So that's, and I think that's kind of a foundational idea in everything I've done.
You're using the body, the figure, the body as an object, vessel, as opposed to you're just stripping away the personality and the character and using the figure in a different way, or
not really. I mean, I think that what happens particularly with the portrait work is that I develop a connection with somebody, you know, internet. I develop a connection with somebody and then make the work from that. So quite often I'd ask them to send me images of themselves, and then I'd use those images, and then there'd be a kind of develop a conversation, and then that conversation would be a kind of influence on what I would do with the work. But over time, you know, the kind of inability to be able to to kind of really have a proper sense of that person, kind of sort of turn into a frustration in making the painting, and then the painting becomes, you know, and then the painting becomes kind of obliterated or changed in that process.
Okay.
So it's like the painting is like a failure of the ability to have a kind of a full sense of the person.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I read somewhere the other day, who was saying it, that you can never, well, someone said that you can never fully know someone else.
Yeah, that's it.
I mean, most people don't know themselves fully, so it would be, and to be honest, I don't know if I'd want to know someone else fully. I certainly don't want to know you fully. do you know what I mean, though? Like, I just, what's the point? If you knew someone fully...
Then it's all done, isn't it?
What's the point?
Yeah, you might as well, it's all finished.
Yeah, but you know, we all have our own, you know, relationship with our inner and outer lives, you know, and I think that, you know, we perform ourselves, you know, this kind of perform an exterior, and then perhaps the performance is the real us in the inner one. You know, I don't quite know what that is, but you know, I've spent quite a lot of my time thinking about, you know, well, you know, what is going on in somebody else's head, you know, what is their experience of things, you know, and I think that I mean, in a way, that comes from growing up somewhere that's quite isolated. You know, when I was a kid, we moved out to the country, and then I was on my own a lot of the time. And so, you know, kind of my inner world became kind of everything. And then, you know, and then beginning to connect to other people as I, you know, got older and went out and met people. And then sort of a bit of a gap, really, thinking that there's a, how do I know this person? How do I connect to them? What's going on within them? And then for much later on, I was working on a project that was about consciousness with another artist. And it was a funded research project. And I really got into thinking about how consciousness is constructed and you know, ideas, theories around consciousness. You know, some really great ideas, like David Chalmers' idea of like this kind of idea of zombie theory, which is that how do you know that other people aren't zombies? You know, that they've not just kind of got nothing going on in their heads at all. Because you can't know, you know, the subjective experience is just... is your own, and that's, I find that really fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating, that whole thing really influenced that part, that work.
But you know, the masking stuff, you know, in a way, what happens with the portraits is they become kind of masks, you know, something I've done, and you know, I've been making versions of masking. I don't know, since the early 90s, you know, in lots of different ways, you know. So I used to make silicone masks and latex masks. I made this whole set of videos in the mid 90s with this kind of latex horse's head, and myself being videoed with this latex horse's head that was kind of on my head that I couldn't breathe in, and it was kind of sucking in and out like this kind of mad thing.
I think I've seen either that or I've dreamt it. Or had a nightmare about it.
I think that might be a dark dream, you know.
Yeah, maybe might be. I have very weird dreams, Hedley. So we won't go there.
Hedley, have you just one second? Have you got anywhere a bit better internet spot? Because you're just breaking up sometimes a little bit. Is that possible? Sorry.
Yeah, get a bit closer to your modem.
I can try. It's a bit crap here. Margate's really terrible for this.
Is it?
That's because you're all artists. Though. No one cares.
No.
Is that a bit better?
Well, I'll let you know. That's great. Thank you. So you've been an artist for a very long time, and you've also, you've done a lot of study.
Yeah.
Art school. Like, what have you done? And like, what have you learned, Hedley?
I've been an academic nearly all my life, actually. You know, so it kind of goes with that. So, you know, the academic life and the kind of study life kind of sort of goes with that. You know, I first went to art school when I was 15. You know, I went to the Saturday art school at Plymouth School of Art, and that kind of like was like a door opening, changed my world. And I was like, okay, this is the place I want to be. And then I went and did a foundation at Falmouth, which, you know, I left home and went there at 17, and then went to Central St Martins and did a degree there. And then went from uh, then Helen Chadwick is my tutor, the artist Helen Chadwick. And,
yeah, I've heard of her.
Yeah, yeah, she's amazing. She was amazing. Really influential on a lot of people in the 90s. And as you talk of a lot of places as a visiting tutor. But she was really great because she said you should apply to the Royal College of Art. And I said, oh, they don't want people like me. You know, I come from a kind of working class background and farm and whatever. I didn't feel like it. I belong there. But she said, you do. And she said, I said, oh, I haven't got any money. You know, I haven't got enough money for the application or putting a portfolio together.
Can you pay Helen?
And she took out her purse and she paid me money. And she helped me put my portfolio together and she put it in a taxi and organised for me to go to that, which was absolutely amazing. Yeah, yeah, totally. And then, but then when I got to the, then I got an interview and then she was on the interview panel.
Oh, stop it. So, did she you know she that?
She helped me to apply and she was on the panel.
Did
and in
she
the interview,
she was
great.
Gonna...
She was just like, and show them that. And she was like this kind of sponsor for me. It was amazing.
That's so cool.
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of lots of things happen all the way through the years that were a bit like that. So kind of really nice mentor people that kind of like helped me along the way. And then you know, after that, even while I was at the Royal College of Art, I started getting teaching jobs, you know, things from contacts, those kind of contacts. And basically I kind of more or less went straight into lecturing right after doing my master's. So I was like 23.
Wow.
And I began lecturing at 23, and then you know, and I pretty quickly went into lecturing full time. Yeah. My first big job was I was doing the art school scene. You know, I was working everywhere. You know, St Mines, Royal College, Camberwell. You know, I was just at Middlesex, Coventry. I was doing lots and lots of guesting everywhere. And it was driving me mad, and I had a different bag by the door for every day. And then the flat that I was renting was being sold, a very London thing, and I was like, I need to buy somewhere. I need to kind of sort this out. So I just applied for the first job I found, and it was really different because it was a lecturer in digital art, and what I did, printmaking and photo media. You know, at some art ends and printmaking at a Royal College, but I spent quite a lot of time mucking about with computers, and they gave me the job, which was weird because you know I didn't quite expect it. So as an artist,
what did digital art mean back then, though?
Yeah, the photo.
Yeah, it was kind of a very different world. So this digital arts course was one of very few in the country.
And
it was kind of artists. It had started off by artists that were mucking about with computers.
Yeah.
But very fast, everything was changing really quickly. So it was games development, digital animation, virtual environments, lots of things like that. And that all started to happen really fast. And the student numbers exploded. It went really crazy. And then the course started to break up into separate courses. But I learned a lot about teaching then. Because it was like you'd have 250 students in a class and multiple classes of the same thing. It was very different to teaching in an art school. It was really, art schools are like, you know, oh, that's really nice. Let's have a tutorial or a seminar with 10 people. This was like production line, hundreds of students. It was absolutely crazy. And it taught me lots about how to teach, you know, delivering 4 serious lectures a week, doing all these kind of big seminar groups, like, it's crazy, but breath by fire, you know, Sunday night I've been tears, you know, kind of the stress of it. I learned a lot, and then I got offered a job at the University of East London and stayed there for about the next 14 years. But, you know, all that time, what happened is I learned all this stuff, and then I learned how to show other people that stuff and talk to them about it. Mm. And so I very quickly became a leader of courses and a manager and a head of school. And all of that. So I ended up in senior management really quickly. So, you know, by the time I was 30, I was in senior management. And
were you painting all this time, Headley?
Yeah. Running the studio all the time and doing stuff, you know, in the background and doing all that. I did a a doctorate alongside that as well.
Dr. Hell, sorry, we should have said.
Oh, yeah, doctor.
Yeah, yeah, it's so amazing. I did a doctorate alongside that, which is kind of a bit crazy as well. And I think now I look back, I just had a really unhealthy relationship to work, just yeah. working too much.
You didn't sleep by the sound of it.
No, not that much, you know, yeah. Yeah, I had a bit
did
of an...
Did you get a buzz off it? Problem. Did you, like, get a real... Yeah. Did it sort of like, the busier you were, the more productive you were?
Yeah, yeah, high all the time. Did lots of really interesting projects. And it was amazing, all of that. And also, you know, and the jobs afterwards, because I was doing stuff with international universities, traveling around the world.
Yeah,
validating courses in Malaysia and being a visiting professor to universities everywhere. And it was just, I mean, it was really mad and intense and brilliant. But also kind of exhausting in the end. Then I went to the University of Bedfordshire to do the same thing. I was on lots of kind of the Council for Higher Education in Art and Design and lobby groups and all this kind of stuff. So kind of proper full-on, you know, advocate for art and design education.
I think you're the most qualified person we've ever spoken to.
I know.
Headley.
I want to come hang out with you,
Headley. Yeah. You've got all the answers, Henry. Yeah.
I've got more letters after my name than before than my actual name. it's really, it just sort of happened. Yeah. Which is really mad for somebody who's at school and you do your career service and they say, well, we think you can either become a labourer or you can join the army.
Because well, that's mad, isn't it? So how did you go with all the writing? Did you, obviously you're absolutely fine with concepts and making the work,
yeah.
but how did you go with the writing element?
Well, when I was at St Martin's, I couldn't write an essay.
Yeah. No, you've got to be taught, you've got to
pretty much fail most of my exams because I just didn't learn. I was in the middle group at school, you know, so they looked after the top ones and they made sure the bottom ones were kind of like trying to bring them up. But it was a difficult time in UK education, so the middle ones were sort of left a bit to their own devices because they were just probably going to go do something else. And I was in that group, you know, so you didn't get taught composition, you didn't get taught essay writing, you didn't really get taught that much.
No.
So I was in the middle of St Martin's and I got my first essay back and I failed it and I was in tears and you know, and kind of like, what do I do? Mm-hmm. And then I was dating this girl and she gave me this book. It was like this about essay writing. It was really old. It was like by the kind of explorer, essays by the explorer Francis Bacon and you know people like that. It was a really old book, but it was like really classic essay writing.
Yeah.
And I read this book and it was like learning old style essay writing. But what I worked out from reading it was that there was a formula to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of like, I've got to learn how to do this. And I read this book and I just read all these kind of mad essays written by all these Victorian, you know, writers. And they're all the same structure. And it was like this kind of like opening up. And I realized that the structure was the obvious bit that I was missing. And then from then onwards, it was kind of easy. So the combination of the structure and then using a computer to write it, because I didn't think in a linear way. So I couldn't sit in an exam and, you know, in my time, you know, handwriting from the top to the bottom was kind of how you did an essay and an exam, but the being able to use a computer in the early 90s, you could kind of cut and paste it backwards and forwards. And that was like, enabled me to work with ideas rather than just a kind of descriptive paraphrasing of some other text.
Yeah. So you're like, seeing it more visually than...
Yeah. So I'd write an idea and then I didn't know where it went. You know, so it was like piecing all this stuff together and then I could chop it up and put it back together again. And I was like, I can do this. And so those two things completely changed everything. And then I went to being an A student.
But do you think that could also translate how you said about finding that book and finding the structure? Like, does that translate to art education? Is there a formula in place that obviously people need to work but is there a formula that you need to learn? Do you need to learn the structure?
The way that I teach and also the way that I've taught other people to teach and also the way that I've structured management is about enabling students to realize that Learning is a structure, and learning how to learn is a skill. It's not so you can perform well in study if you learn how to do it, learn how to learn, or learn how to show learning. That's it. So the trick to being a student and doing well in a student is showing how you've learned something.
Yeah. So read that the marking criteria.
Yeah, read all the criteria, but it's a display. Yeah. You know, so when you're assessing somebody, you're looking for them to tell you what they know and what they've learned. So enabling them, the students, to understand that that they're talking to somebody when they're presenting their work all the time. So there's somebody looking at it, whether it's a PhD submission or whether it's a portfolio, they're talking to somebody. And they've got to imagine who that person is, and then they've got to deliver it in a way that they can best present themselves. And there are formulas and structures to doing that. So I do quite a lot of PhD supervision now, and you know, and that's absolutely a formula. You know, a very tight structure to work with. And once you realise that working in that structure, actually, it's a lot easier than you think it is. But I didn't have that magic at the beginning, but now, you know, one of the things that I learned, you know, myself, and then was really passionate about enabling, was people that didn't have those opportunities to have that kind of education. People like me, you know, I was really interested in working in places where I could help those people get those opportunities. So that's why I ended up working at places like University of East London, because they have a broad admissions policy. And they take in people who haven't necessarily got the best the best kind of privilege.
Totally. Because it's
You can change your life. It's amazing.
I bet.
It's become so expensive globally to study, and it just pushes out so many people.
Continues the poverty gap.
It's very frustrating.
But what have you seen over the years of you know, in a student, like, what is it about a student that you think
you love this question?
I do. Like, you know, whatever you deem as a success, and obviously you probably follow students after they've left. Like, are they asking the questions? Are they open to learning? Are they mad? Are they like, what is it? Or is there no formula? It just is. I don't know.
When I was doing lots with the admissions process and bringing students in, what I really, really liked is all the crazy stuff at the back of a sketchbook, or the things that they hid. You know, so when I was looking for new students, it was like they would come in with a portfolio, and they and if they were doing a course, the portfolio would look the same as everybody else's.
Yeah.
And you know, and so I'll be like, okay, so where's the biro drawings at the back of the book?
Yeah.
You know, where's the stuff that you don't show anybody? You know, and I don't care if it's men's bottoms or, you know, monsters or manga or whatever the hell it is. That's what you want to see, because that's the real you. That's the artist in there. So the other stuff is, you know, structure, and then that's the interesting just stuff.
Ticking,
you know,
the boxes, the other stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
that's what I look at. That's what I love. And then, you know, that enabling that person to be that best version of that magical kind of psychological, you know, themselves, and enabling the confidence to become that thing.
To trust. So getting students to understand to trust their individuality and their creativity, and to not follow the pack, to be brave, to go, this is what I'm about.
Yes. No matter what, you know, kind of, no matter what. Find the voice, pursue it. Pursue it no matter what. So and you know, the success, you know, as I've always taught the students, success is still doing it. Success is still doing it, you know, in your 80s. Success is kind of is forever being committed to carry on making those spiro drawings in the back of your notebook, you know, forever. It's the version of that. You know, some people are really successful, and you know, financially or with external validation or that kind of stuff, and others aren't. But if you're still doing it, you know, and that's at the center of your kind of you know, positive self-image. You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter if you're working in a shop or you know, yeah. It doesn't matter what you do. You know, yeah. I think that's really important. So for me, it's always been about that kind of the foundation of your kind of lived experience. You know, that's the success part.
Definitely. Well, we really, really enjoyed the bit you wrote in this little book, The Navigator of the Art World.
Yeah, the Delphian Gallery. That's how I found out about you, actually.
It's such a great essay.
Yeah, they're great.
You're very eloquent, yeah. Hedley, and so bang on with the points that you cover, which, you know...
She's made notes.
Oh, I've made notes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
I've made notes.
Look at that.
On an old piece of diary from my son. Everything gets recycled. Everything gets recycled in this house. But I really like the way you broke it down and you talked about success and how, you know, what kind of artist you want to be? What do you want to make? I really found that really empowering, because so much is focused on the whole being financially successful or getting into the gallery, whereas what you were just saying, I mean, we all need to eat and we want to be able to make enough money to live, but that's so refreshing to keep hearing that. And the other thing I really liked was that you talked about things that you need to do in order to be professional. I guess it's like to document your work, to manage your finances. And the one that I really loved was that you talked about the making and the reflecting, where you're talking about you get into the flow, which is the bit we all love, but then we've got to bloody write about it. but it's true. But you gave a really good tip, which is like just keep that journal going, which I've got about 200 of them, and it's a good opportunity. And Julie uses her journal for, you know, she writes down, and she loves that for her painting names.
I've got a journal.
Will you write in the little
bookie? I write on my notes and I suppose I do write
you
down.
Do.
I don't, I'm not religious with it, but I suppose I do.
So we we make some kind
of different kinds of journaling, you know, there are lots of different kinds of that, you know, but the most important bit is like reflecting on it, you know, and kind of remember being giving yourself the space to understand that you can be in it and making it, and then you can have another process, which is the reviewing it. And they're not I don't think they're necessarily the same thing.
No.
You know, standing back and looking at it, and then, you know, if you're somebody who remembers stuff, you can journal in your head, if you like, you know.
Yeah.
A notation that happens.
But do you think,
as long as that process is happening?
Do you, because we spoke to a local artist and who's also a teacher at the National Art School in Sydney, and he spoke about how he doesn't work in bodies of work. He just keeps painting. So, like, sometimes you would think there's a natural pause, you know, when you've finished a body of work, perhaps for a show, so that, you know, that's when you've got to really reflect. But do you think that you should be, like, some people rewrite their artist statement every 3 months, say. Like, is there a good formula to follow?
It makes it sound like I'm just really advocating the kind of like body of work and then the statement, which is kind of not really true. So I think that the kind of artists that do that work continually, really, they're just picking up the last trail of, you know, the last part of the last piece of work into the new one, aren't they? It's sort of like knitting or something. You know, it's kind of each piece is knitted into the last one endlessly, you know. And I think that, but they will have a reflective process. You know?
Definitely.
It's just, it might be much shorter. It might be at the end of a day or the beginning of a day, or, you know, there is, you know, it's done in a slightly different way rather than something that's kind of big.
It can be an ongoing thing.
Write a statement.
Yeah,
absolutely, it can be. You know, it might be. It's like, you know, that those 20 minutes of having a cup of coffee in the morning or smoking a cigarette or whatever people do.
Yeah.
But that, you know, realizing that is part of the practice as well. Definitely. As the making.
What's
part.
The looking, you know, time? I've often said that. You know, and I love Agnes Martin videos I've seen of her working. I think she's the epitome of the more time looking than doing. And I just think that's so powerful to watch, because it does make you slow down and realize.
But also I think, you know, like when you have a show, like it's really important for artists to put their work outside the studio in a different space, because when you talk to other people about your work, that's when you almost formulate some of your ideas in your head. You haven't even sort of quite got it all together, and then that's the moment. Like, you've got to keep talking explaining to people and explaining it, haven't you? You can't really
I think so. Keep talking to people about it. I've always advocated the things you need to be an artist, they aren't necessarily a degree, an education or whatever. They're time and space and a network of people to talk to about what you're doing. Those are the three things you need, you can get that in lots of different ways.
I think talking
to people is really, really important.
Who do you talk to about your work?
Going back to what you were saying about the exhibition, I think that when I started out, that was everything.
Yeah.
So it was like the big reveal, like some kind of magician's trick.
Yeah.
You'd work in a studio for ages, nobody would see what you were doing, and then you'd kind of reveal it. It'd be like the grand opening, and everybody would come to it. And then the openings were everything. Everybody went to multiple numbers in a week. It was like this relentless conveyor belt of that. But that's the only place that you saw work. And it was very much that reveal, that kind of it complete, like it was it had come from nowhere. You never saw the process of things happening. And that was the process was only really disclosed really in art schools or studio visits, kind of having special access,
It was very secret.
Obviously social media just blew that out, blew that out of the way. And I was an early advocate of lots of, technology and technology enabling artists. So, in 2005, 2006, I started to showing other academics and artists, look at this stuff, we can share studio practice, we can share stuff, we can kind of show painting processes, and you can show making stuff, and you can show it in progress, and that's going to change everything. And it blew up, and it was, and I think that has radically changed the way that artists work now. So there's the exhibition reveal, but we're also familiar with also what's going on day to day in artist studios in a really fast way. And of course, lots of different artists work differently, and there are lots that don't do the social media and don't show things, but most do. And I've got a student that's doing some research into this and looking at trying to analyze the feedback loops and how they've changed, and interviewing artists about the effect of social media on how they make work, whether they're posting it means that they make different decisions that they might not have made if they were alone. And that's really all really interesting. Responses. And but the mixed responses and the conflict, because some artists are saying, no, I'm not influenced by social media, but then they say, well, yeah, but I like to get feedback every day on what I'm doing. And then they'll say, but I made a painting and then I destroyed it, but people liked it, so I made another one of the same one. And you kind of think, well, you are being influenced, of course.
Yeah.
So it is really interesting.
But don't you think
that's a very different process?
Don't you think more so you're influenced by other people's work on Instagram? Because I find it really hard to look at, I've said this many times, but and I believe that you could literally look at no artist in the world and still still come up with amazing artwork. Like, I don't know that you have to be, and especially now, like, people used to do deep dives, I think, through books and libraries and going to shows on a few artists and really deep dive. Like, David Hockney goes so deep into one artist, like he's
obsessed.
Now we're flick, all these images, find it's way too much. I sort of start almost copying. I'm like, oh, I'll do that, and I can't see it all.
It's kind of you get this kind of flicker thing that happens, don't you? Your sense of visuals. I mean, I was a deep dive, a big part of what I enjoyed when I was a student and as being an academic, was the opportunity to get access to great libraries and just kind of spend whole days. I'd take a day and even as when I was ahead of school, I'd take a day and say, right, okay, I'm going to disappear, and I just go to a library and then just follow a train of thought through a bunch of books. You know,
I'd love to do that.
Art books and encyclopedias, and that were my kind of starting point. You know, an encyclopedia of art history was the, you know, where I be, my first introduction to being an artist. Nobody was an artist, for, you know, and I knew when I was young, and that art history just is the kind of foundation for me. So the deep diving into, you know, finding out about somebody and then reading a biography of, you know, Augustus John, and, you know, looking at all the work and then reading about Gwen John and his sister and all the relationships, and then find, you know, how all the relationships with all the other artists and how that works. And that became really kind of exciting for me. It's like you can open all the doors to finding out about somebody. Mm. And so that, again, you know, I suppose that's an academic approach maybe, but...
But who have you had a big deep dive? Like, who's made a big impact on you and your work?
Yeah,
creatively. Yeah, that's always a big interesting question, isn't it? Augustus John is a kind of, you know, I had a big kind of thing for him for a long time. I kind of been it really for a long time sort of interested in. Sort of pre-modern, you know, kind of like that, in a way, the 100 years that precede that, and kind of all the things that happened that then connected on, that then built up into modernism. And I think that, you know, sort of strange Victorian artists and stuff, and symbolists and von Stuck, and, you know, I mean, loads of stuff, you know, I'm an academic, so it's really hard. It's because you sort of, I think that means that you end up looking at lots and lots of people and lots of, you know, so it's hard for me to say, like, oh yeah, you know, here's Matisse is a major influence, or here's Picasso is a major influence, or is that, because it's this
combination
network.
Of a lot.
And my you know, that foundational moment, I've got this book that had 20,000 images of this encyclopedia book when I was 10 years old. And it was like all these tiny little photographs of, you know, through art history. And I sort of became a bit obsessed with this book, like linking between all the different artists, you know, kind of trying to understand how does this, I mean, I was 10 years old, so it's prepubescent kind of fantasy. So how is this nude in this, you know, in this, you know, period connect with this one, you know, so.
How do I connect to Paul Westerman?
Yeah, no. How's Cranach connected to Tom Wesselman, you know? No. So, so, you know, you know, 10 years old and think, you know, of course, you know. And that really sort of ended up being a sort of foundation for the way that I kind of think about looking at art. And so it's hard to say, yeah, that for me, there's this great master. You know, I've read, you know, biographies on loads of people, you know, Matisse, obviously, you know, like everybody, but it's harder for me to say that, I think.
It
was a really interesting question. When I did my doctorate, it was the professor said, right, okay, you know, tell me who's the most influential artist, and I found it really difficult to do that.
Have you still got that encyclopedia, Hedley?
Yeah,
I love that. Yeah. Did your mum buy it?
I know.
Did your mum buy it?
Yeah, she joined a book club.
Yeah.
You know, she joined like one of those Reader's Digest book clubs.
I think I know the one you mean.
Yeah, Christopher Lloyd is.
Yeah, because we're the same age, God help us.
Yeah.
72.
Yeah, do you know what? One of the it's got holes cut in it in the pictures, because I wrote an back in the day when you couldn't get Reaper graphics done, you know, really easily like you can now. Getting photographs to put into an essay was really difficult. And I remember having to submit this essay and thinking, I need a picture. I really need a picture. And I couldn't work out how to get it. So I just cut the picture out of the book. So it's got like holes in it.
I love it.
Where I wanted that picture and put it in an essay.
that is an artwork in itself. Yeah. You can do it all.
I was thinking that would be
amazing.
Cool.
Well, look, tell us about your work. Like, how do you, how's your process? Like, I can see, obviously, you're working on canvas, easels. Like, how do you go about making a painting?
I'm a bit like this research, I suppose. You know, I'm always working on lots of different things at the same time. So I'm not really one of those artists that kind of goes, you know, here's that thing, and then you kind of repeatedly make it, and so it becomes almost, you know, it stands for you like a kind of brand image. So I'm not really like that. So I've got multiple things going on at the same time all the time, and I'm quite open about sharing what I'm doing. So, you know, I think sometimes that can be a bit confusing, but I've got a kind of, I'm working on mostly on canvas, but at the moment I've got a kind of kissing series of paintings that I've been making for quite a long time. But then I'm also making these new kind of mask things called, that I've been calling New Gods, which started from drawings. And I'm also making these kind of deconstructed paintings. So,
They are so cool. They are really exciting. Oh my God, I pissed my pants over those. Because they're like 3D freaking paintings. Oh my God, I love them.
Yeah, I know. So what I've been doing is making the work and making the paintings, and then when they're finished, cutting them up. Which is kind of like cutting them up. So I was working with a fashion designer, and we started to work with a method to which is like what's called a living hinge.
Okay.
And what they use it for bending wood. So what you do is make lots of kind of cuts into the wood, and then you can bend the wood. You know, so like if you follow stuff on Etsy and things like, you know, or YouTube videos, you can see people have made plywood, and they've like a plywood book cover, and it's one piece of wood, and they've cut like this lattice of slats into it, and then it folds the book around. So it makes a hard thing flexible, and a painting's really hard. So I had this idea that I wanted to make the actual paintings into garments. So I started working with this fashion designer, and she came to my studio and started to work with it, and she said, this is a nightmare because the painting's too thick. So we were chopping stuff up, and it was just like, it ended up being these kind of like really kind of two restrictive things, which at one point I kind of liked. But then she went away and she said, look, you know, I've got this thing where I've cut this lattice and it can stretch. So yeah, then I then we made some really kind of, we just started cutting these lattices into these into my paintings, big paintings, you know. So 2 meter by 2 meter paintings of these kind of lattices cut into them, and then they could be draped over and making these kind of veil things where you could see through the lattices and also see the painting as well. And then I started doing laser cutting paintings with these sort of these patterns that I was working on that would then open the painting up, so you'd see the painting but then have a pattern in it. And then so these living hinge patterns could be adapted, and then when you pull it apart, I'd make them and then they'd fall apart, so sections would fall out of it, and then you'd have this kind of lacy lattice of the painting. So I've been doing stuff like that, and then I'm doing some experiments with that where I'm making the painting and then making drawing on the painting and then using the drawing on the painting to become the lattice. So that's kind of sounds really complicated, but basically the painting is made, and then you can draw the lattice living hinge that then makes it flexible, and then getting it laser cut so that it then becomes flexible with a drawing that's in it, but you can still see the painting. So that's all going on in the background.
Come and see this.
But, are you trying to play with what the idea of like a painting is?
But
also the idea of what a body is underneath it, and what we show and reveal, which is the same idea as the masking, that's kind of made physically manifest. You know, so I think that idea of what we show and what we don't show is quite to each other, and how we kind of connect. So the kissing paintings are kind of, you know, quite romantic, quite straightforward, but they're weird because they're merged together.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they're about connecting and trying to connect but remaining separate, whereas the portraits and the masking and revealing are about the, you know, what we give up and what we don't give up. of ourselves. So
you need to collaborate with a therapist, I think, Headley. You'd go off.
No, I think it would ruin.
Why? Because I need therapy.
No, you don't. You don't. It will ruin all these great ideas. But do So you did a lot of printmaking, you were saying. Do you still do printmaking?
Yeah. Printmaking got me into computers, really, I think. And so I'm not really afraid to use computers as a way of, as a part of a process. When I was in doing digital arts, there was a big discussion around the integrity of digital arts, which was really interesting. So the idea of digital art being a subject in and of its own about digital art, which is different perhaps from the artist using digital art as a tool. So I think now I use it as a tool, you know, so like a, you know, like any other tool in the studio, you know, I'll move something into digital now again. But in the late 90s and 2000s, it was also, we were interested in, could it be a subject in and of itself? Making digital art about digital art, that's kind of interesting. So I've been involved in lots of different things.
What's your feelings about the old NFTs?
The old, the new.
Oh, the new, sorry. Well, they're old now.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge subject, isn't it? And I've kind of spent, I'm interested in all that stuff. So I've spent a lot of time looking at it. I've kind of been in and out of, I've almost got to making them and then gone out again. I know lots of people that have. But I mean, as a technology, I think it's probably the smart contract is the interesting bit. And the idea that a smart contract for an object, you know, in the world, so the relationship between the digital and the physical, and things being in a sense digitally validated inside a system that it doesn't require an external authority, you know. So the smart contract enables that work to be like a work of art to be validated as being made authenticated by that person, and you know, and the rules around the way that that gets managed is actually in the artwork itself. It isn't housed anywhere else, and I think that's really interesting. So think about, you know, it's kind of like I keep thinking about solar wit and rule, you know, art rule based art and kind of things like that. But that's kind of the model. It's a really interesting conceptual model, and when that explodes and becomes in everything, so that the authentication of all objects becomes through a digital system, that's going to really change our whole world, I think. So I think it's more than just JPEGs
and the fact the way that artists, I suppose, you know, will always get paid for that artwork whenever it gets sold, it changes everything, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It also changes things like crowdfunding and stuff like that as well. So, you know, you can build any kind of contract for it. So imagine that you were an artist starting out, you know, so you're a young artist, you graduate, and you want to get sponsorship, patronage, support, validation. You know, if you and you get a little bit of interest, you know, imagine that you were to then create a smart contract that then gave your first buyers a kind of a small percentage of, you know, they're becoming like direct investors. Yeah. That contract enables them to have a 1% in your future for the next 10 years. You know, so you can have a kind of bonding system, you know, that would be built into a smart contract. You know, for Tracy Emin, you know, we talked about earlier on, basically sold bonds in our own work. You know, I think that those kinds of ideas about the way that patronage works. Will be radically changed if, you know, some people start to think about them.
How it used to work, you know, the art world, you did have a patron and it...
Yeah, well, everybody can be a patron, you know, but, you know, the collector market is kind of patronage, of course. And, you know, and the emergence of the collector market and also the emergence of fast flipping and how that whole scene works and, you know, and the emergence of... you know, artwork explicitly is kind of stock, like holding, selling, holding, you know, that's part of the whole language. You know, we all know that that's going on. People getting into syndicates, investment groups for buying artwork. And, you know, there's a whole world of investment that's very like banking. And that's, you know, that whole language is mixing up with art so quickly and so easily. And I think that the stigma around that's moving has moved out, certainly since I was started out. And I think younger artists will come in and they'll kind of see these systems and see ways of using them that we can't imagine yet. That will mean that they'll go, right, okay, I can get a whole group of sponsors to kind of help me get started without having to catch the eye of a major collector or major gallery, so that you can build energy to launch a career. I think that's really interesting.
That is fascinating. I never really thought about that. Like it's sort of like away from the digital space of art to have some sort of, like you say, digital contract, even on like a canvas work, you could still have a digital contract. I mean, it sort of explodes the gallery model. I mean, I don't know where they're going to be left in the future unless they start putting their percent in as well. Like, why would artists go with a gallery?
Yeah, but all of that can be wrapped in, so it's just the gallery model is under pressure, the 50%, but it's been under pressure for a while, particularly at the lower end of the market, where artists, the relationship between artists and galleries is made tense because for the gallery, like a gallery in London, it's incredibly expensive to run, and so they can struggle to make that happen. If they take risks of that, is that they don't necessarily have the funds and money to support the young artists or other marketing and all the other kind of things that an artist used to get supported for, but now probably does more of themselves. So it's definitely under pressure. The expectation for an artist to produce high quality photographs themselves that they then give to the gallery. When 10, 20 years ago, that was being done by the gallery in the exhibition of the photographs. But now it needs to be done before, because they need to be released to collectors beforehand in a pre-sale and all this other stuff. There's so much going on.
It's really tough.
It is tough. Particularly at that emerging kind of, which is so important.
In Australia, I know that we have a lot of people go to art school, and there's a very small proportion of them continue. It's just the fact of the way it is now, that there's not that many graduates actually go on to be a full-time artist. Is it still the same in the UK?
I think that's being a full-time artist is
bloody hard.
I think that's quite tough. I think that's really hard. But I've always advocated that there's more models than that. Things like the Artist Support Pledge have created a new world. The interesting stuff of things that have happened because of the pandemic is that some of the stigma around sharing work, freely sharing work to be affordable, and selling it through the internet, that's all changed. That's like a massive, massive change. And that's enabling people that perhaps struggled 5 years ago to then be really successful. I've got friends that have gone from finding it difficult to get by to making a very good living because of that program,
Isn't that great?
The Artist Support Pledge. So what they did was, they went through their back catalogue of studies and drawings and works, and then they just regularly kind of put that out, £200, knock it out. And people are buying that, collecting that kind of stuff. And then what's often happening is then getting another sale from that. And then, or a conversation or a commission, something really successful. So suddenly there's a kind of a whole much faster way of working a kind of financial security that's not dependent on, a gallery, very often, there is a gallery, there are galleries, it is attached to that, but that day-to-day security isn't being upheld by a bar job or a teaching job or whatever. It's being upheld by this other mechanism. And that's the main fear for artists, is that day-to-day security, I think.
Definitely, bread and butter, isn't it?
How do you get by from that? How do you keep that steady income running? Because you know, we all know that galleries can go in and out, they can fall, you know, that can work and not work, and you know, you can be with one for a while and then with another one, you know, it's all that stuff, you know. But if you can make a steady income stream on your own, you know, and build that, then you can be, all the other stuff can be built on top of it.
Yeah. Well, just to explain to the Australian listeners, yeah. But I think the artist support pledge in the pandemic was like an Instagram page that was set up where people could
buy
art, and
you. Well, yeah. So if you sold £1,000 worth of art, you then bought 200 with that money.
Right.
You would buy £200 worth of art.
Yeah. So Matthew Burrows set it up, and it was. I mean, really, it's just a hashtag artist support pledge. And then a kind of contract that he said to the artists, okay, £1,000. So if you sell £1,000 worth of work, then you buy £200 worth of art from another artist. And so what you've got is artists collecting other artists. And really, the beginnings of that were, you know, the pandemic. Oh shit! You know, how are we all going to survive? Lots of people lost work. Lots of people lost jobs. Exhibitions, all that stuff. You know, and it was a really great way for artists to kind of collect other artists and support each other, you know, and that's really where it began. And then, of course, you know, collectors get into it, and you know, you get this explosion of it, really. And people start selling all kinds of mad things. Sometimes I think you really shouldn't be selling that for £200. That's not a £200 piece of work, you know. And you kind of wonder about how, the longevity of people's careers and stuff like that. You know, but it is if you want to buy art and you want, you know, starting out as a collector, you just kind of go on Instagram, put in artist support pledge hashtag. It's everywhere. It's absolutely huge.
And it's great because it gets good art on walls as well, gets rid of all the crap, and makes people think, oh, I can afford that. I think it's really refreshing on lots of levels.
Well, Grayson Perry just said it's just important to get it out there, get it into people's houses, into their rooms. You know, every single piece that you've got, you know, in somebody's house is an exhibition.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's it.
It's all a conversation starter.
Mm. Yeah. Somebody go, you know, everybody has friends, everybody, you know, everybody has people come around their house, everybody kind of like, oh, I like that. And then they, you know, and then they, where does it come from? And then you get another one and another one, and that's how it works. You know?
Yeah, it's good.
That's how you build it up.
It's so exciting that the way the internet is making small collectives so big, and this sort of story can just become really huge. It is really exciting. The internet is good sometimes.
A bit overwhelming, as you say. You know, I was just, you know, before this, I was thinking, oh, you know, when you're thinking about contemporary art and that flicker, and I was thinking, oh yeah. So if you ask me, you know, who was I looking at right now? And I don't know. Just kind of like, you know, I see thousands of images of people's artwork every day, and it's like I just scrolling through it all, and I love it, but it's like this wall of kind of stuff. It's really hard to separate out, but you know, I like that.
Yeah,
I know. I feel like I need a break every now and again.
Yeah, we do,
but I do all the Instagram for Art Wank, so I have to keep bloody looking. But I'd like to sort of do a month of no Instagram and not looking at anyone else's work and just see what happens anyway.
I think I go off and look at old artists for a while, you know, I kind of shut it off for a bit, and then go off and look at artists from history, you know, and that gives me a space away from it.
I feel like dead artists are good to look at because they're you've got like a hindsight with dead artists. Do you know what I mean? Like a dead one, they're not making anything new. Everyone's talked about them and you know where they are in the canon of history. Am I still shouting?
Yeah,
he can hear me though, loud and clear, can't he?
I can hear you. It's good. I like that. It's passionate.
Thank you, Hedley.
She's very passionate, but she's making me deaf in my right ear.
I'm just saying, dead artists are easier to look at because
they're dead.
Well, it feels like they're. I don't know. I don't know where to. I don't know what to think about a lot of very contemporary art. It's not been talked about enough. It's not been sitting in a place. I find it really hard to not judge it, but know if it's good or not. I mean, I'm not.
That's what Doig says, isn't he? He says, we don't know whether we don't know whether this is a masterpiece yet. Or, you know, we need 500 years
time.
Before we're going to know that. Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting idea that, you know, but it's really great when you look back through history and then you start doing, you know, diving through it and looking at, I don't know, you kind of pick a period and you say, okay, I'm going to look at this 10-year period of who was making what. And then you suddenly find there are thousands of artists making stuff and, you know, and so many different names. And you realize that actually, you know, there are always lots and lots of people working, making stuff all the time.
Yeah.
You know, so I like going back and looking at Victorian era artists because there were so many. And you sort of think that's a bit like now. There's this kind of an explosion of collectors. And I very much often think that the Victorian period is very similar because there's an explosion of the Industrial Revolution. And we've got something very similar happening now. And I like that, creating that kind of parallel. Yeah, you know,
that's so interesting.
Yeah, I think all that's really interesting.
Yeah,
dead artists can be reinvented as well as the dealers like to do. So that's really interesting.
That is true.
We can steal.
We could write about 10 essays just on these ideas, Hedley.
Definitely. So
now, what is it that keeps you making art? Like, what compels you to make art and has been for so long? Like, how do you get over the days where you're like, oh my God, or do you not have them? Do you have days where you're like, I don't want to do this anymore?
No, never.
Good on you, Hedley.
Yes. You can tell you're probably the most driven person I've ever spoken to. I love it.
Yeah, I know, that's a bit bad sometimes.
I think it's bloody brilliant. Crazy. There's too many wafty people in the world. Fuck that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't work all the time and every day, and I'm not every day making something, but I don't really see the difference between
thinking.
Thinking and making and researching, it's all part of the same thing. And so if there's a lull, you know, if you're kind of like, oh, I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do with that, then I'll go and pick up a book, or I'll go for a walk, or I'll go and look at something, and it doesn't seem like it's not connected to me.
Yeah.
So separating out making and not making, you know, as a, this is, I'm doing an art, I'm being an artist now I'm not being an artist.
Yeah.
It's kind of, yeah.
It's life.
So, yeah, it's just light. It's like breathing, or, you know, so for me, and has been ever since being a kid, because it's like the magic place, you know.
Ever since
like
you chopped up that book.
Yeah, even before that, you know, kind of starting off drawing birds and stuff like that when you're a kid, and then getting told off for drawing naked girls by my mum, and, you know, just, you know.
As I said, you grew up in Cornwall, Hedley. Yeah. It's what happened.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I grew up in Cornwall.
So what advice have you got for our vast listenership of emerging artists in Australia? What would your top tips be?
My top tips are, if you're a drawer, it's easy, draw, you know, but you need that foundation of whatever that activity is, the go-to thing that you do, you know. And my go-to things are, you know, reading and drawing. You know, if I get stuck, I'll find something to go back to. And you know, you want to try and find that activity that makes you feel secure, you know, in being an artist, you know, that you do, that's like takes you back to the core place. You know, I think that for me, that's the most fundamental thing, because that, you know, you need that place that brings you to that safe place that brings you security to kind of go back out again. And so, because there's always wobbles, there's always shit stuff that happens. There'll be a,
I can't do this anymore. Shit.
I know. It'll be a crit or a relationship breakup or you know, whatever. Something, you know, something horrible will happen, and you'll feel terrible. But if you've got that thing in, it's a safe place. Then you'll always be good, you know. A thing that doesn't need to be validated by anybody else. And it doesn't matter whether that's taking photographs or drawing or writing in a notebook or, you know, or even colouring in, you know, really, it really doesn't matter. Whatever works for you, but that have that thing that you know is at the core. And then always remember that core is the thing that's unchallengeable. So I had a tutor that said to me that, you know, in a way, when you're teaching a student, you have to try and appreciate what's at the core of what they do, and respect that. And so and not push them to the point at which you challenge too hard the core, because that will help us, that corrupt and makes them, destabilizes them, and sometimes makes them not able to make work again for a long time.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's in a way, that's going back to what I was saying at the beginning. You know, when you meet a new student and you're trying to find out who they are at the very, you know, what's at the center of what they do. And that thing, once you kind of see it, you can kind of see it forever through them. And that's what that's how they progress. And if that's a photographer, it's a photograph. If it's if they're a graphic designer, they might be taking photo, they might be photographs or notations of things that they've seen. If they're interior designer, it might be books or magazine. I don't know what it is. It doesn't really matter what it is. As long as it might be scrapbooks that they do. I don't care. You can talk about lots of stuff about being successful and all of that. But in the end, I think kind of if you're going to do this forever, you know, then you need to have that security, you know, no matter what, absolutely no matter what. The thing that you always feel good about doing. That's how I thought, you know. There's a thousand sheets of paper on my desk here, you know, and so every there's a day, you know, it's sort of like a stack of paper. And if I go, oh, I'm having a crappy day, I'll just kind of like pull the paper out and just start drawing again.
Yeah.
Then, it feels, you know, like
everything's good.
Yeah, I feel like you're describing like a bit like when people say, oh, what's your guilty pleasure, say in music or something. And it's like owning your guilty pleasure.
That's what you meant, and chocolate.
And then translating that to people so that you're owning it, because your guilty pleasures are probably the most interesting things about you. It's not, yeah, it's the absolutely. Ones that you're secretly owning because you're a bit scared, or, you know, and not maybe the whole population are behind you. So the fact that you love Barry Manilow will fucking make work about Barry Manilow. Like, how interesting.
Yeah, 100%. That is it. That is the answer. You know, whatever your thing is, you know, and that's what I think, that, you know, everybody has a capacity to be an artist, because if you get in touch with that thing and you go, what's your thing, that you can make that into being an artist. It doesn't matter if it's collecting trains. You know, if you're obsessed with trains, then you go there. You know, that can become art. To find that thing, and then that thing becomes the core of the practice. And then all as the kind of performance of being an artist, and the kind of the output of being an artist, and the kind of object, collectible, whatever it is. You know, they're the manifestations of the core.
Yeah.
The core activity. You know. So, you know, the Barry Manilow. Your Barry Manilow obsession, you know, that's just started off collecting records, that becomes an obsession, could end up being you as a drag performer, but you making paintings,
you're making t-shirts,
hundreds of other artists to make portraits of Barry Manilow and curating an exhibition of them. All that, you know, just that one thing suddenly turns into a lifetime of practice.
I
love that.
Yeah. So it's really just not being ashamed about what, as you say, is your safe place. And that's quite refreshing to hear from a teacher as well, because often I feel like art teachers perhaps want you to always be striving to be out your comfort zone all the time. And sometimes you do just want to be in your comfort zone until you're ready to strike out and do something outside your comfort zone.
Tea and chocolate.
Being an artist is really hard. Being an artist is really, really hard. It makes you very vulnerable. It makes you psychologically vulnerable, emotionally vulnerable. It's an incredibly difficult process. You know, I don't think that people that don't do it don't realise just how vulnerable you are in that. And it doesn't matter how old you are, you remain vulnerable when doing it. And it's a kind of, there's a masochism in that, you know. You know.
Definitely. You know, and a narcissism.
There's a kind of strange joy in the process of making yourself so bloody vulnerable, you know, to other people. But so as a teacher, you know, I think that you push people into out of their comfort zone, but you've got to appreciate that the comfort zone needs to exist as well. So I try to separate the two things out and try to think that there's the core of what you do, which is the comfort place, and then there's these kind of various manifestations of it. And they can be challenged. So So you can say, okay, I'm challenging your painting of Barry Manilow, but I'm not challenging the fact that you want to make paintings of Barry Manilow.
We could bloody talk to you for hours. You are amazing.
We need to go back to, do you remember Rent-A-Ghost?
I love it.
Rent-A-Ghost.
When you used to be able to go, then we could be in my place. I want to do that.
Well, can I come there? It's a bit warmer.
You can come here anytime.
I've either got menopause or it's fucking hot tonight. Hedley, we've kept you for a very long time. That was so seriously good. Interesting conversation. Thank you so much.
I'm glad.
My bucket is full.
Yeah, you're very inspiring, Hedley.
You are.
I wish you were my teacher.
Yeah, can you be our teacher?
I quite like talking.
Correspondent. Can you do correspondence with us?
You do online courses.
Yeah, do you do online?
Oh, yeah. No, I haven't, but...
Yeah. Well, Hedley, just before you go, like, have you got a show coming up that we can tell people about?
I'm not doing that. I'm trying to work towards a book.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, I know. I've got lots of work that I'm making and I'm showing people, but I slowed down a lot during lockdown. Gosh. And then I've got a bit reclusive, to be quite honest. But you know, I'm sharing a lot of stuff on the internet. But I am making this quite a lot. I'm making these really explicit drawings at the moment.
It's your guilty pleasure.
Yeah. Explicit drawings of people that people
share. Making me blush. I'm just thinking
about
that.
I know. It's just a bit like that revealing, concealing thing. I was talking to Ben Murphy from Delphin Gallery about it yesterday, and I've talked to a couple of others, but kind of thinking about the way forward for it, because I don't just want to do that thing on Instagram where you kind of put up an image and then you cover up the naughty bits, you know, because I think that's a bit rubbish. I've got quite a lot of them now, and
Do you have to cover up?
I feel a bit embarrassed about it, and then I'm thinking, no, well, sod it. I'm just going to make them and do it, and then work out a way of putting them out. So
wonderful! Thank you so much. You are amazing to talk to. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We might have to do part two.
I know. I think we do need part two.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Have a great day, and I hope you perform up. Thanks, Hedley.
Nice to meet you.
Bye.
Go and have a Jaffa cake.
Bye.
Please don't forget to rate and review and share this podcast. It helps my mum and her friend Fiona get more listeners. Thank you.